everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And here we are. It's July 29, 2014. How are you today? Well, so much is going on. I was at the Head and Neck Cancer Congress on Sunday. Right. What was the lone vegan doing at the Head and Neck Cancer opening ceremonies? It was kind of an incredible event. I have all kinds of good and bad feelings about it, and I wrote an article about it, which you could read at my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, called A Visit to the Head and Neck Cancer Congress. I was invited, and it was the 100th anniversary of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center opening their Head and Neck Cancer Center. I don't know if you know anything about head and neck cancers, but some of them can be horrible, and the treatments are horrible. And I kept questioning myself as I saw this opulent parade of nations during the opening ceremonies, and this lovely flute and harp concert, and all kinds of wonderful things going on. I kept asking myself, what are we celebrating? And, of course, my favorite part was the reception when people went to get their little snacks and look at the exhibiting vendors and equipment salespeople, and you know what was served. No anti-cancer superfoods. No. All those cancer-promoting foods like processed white flour foods, bagels, cream cheese, all the doctor's favorites. I'm going to talk more about this later, but I just wanted to direct you to that article that I wrote at my website. And let's move on to my first guest. This is going to be really fun. Bob Linden, vegan for 30 years. He is the host and producer of the weekly two-hour nationally syndicated nonprofit program Go Vegan Radio with Bob Linden, which you can find at goveganradio.com. Previously broadcast on the Air America Radio Network and CBS and Clear Channel radio stations, his weekly vegan animal liberation commentary has been heard on KPFA, the San Francisco Bay Area Pacifica radio station. Bob emcees the World Veg Fest annually in Golden Gate Park in October and was the original organizer of World Fest, a vegan festival in Los Angeles. He's currently organizing the World Vegan Summit and Expo in March in the Los Angeles area. You could find out more at worldvegansummit.com and so much more. Bob, how are you doing?
Thank you, Karen. I think I need a nap listening to how much I'm doing. So, really?
Oh God!
No, I don't need a nap. I'm full of vegan energy. So,
well, yeah, you know, I hear you. It doesn't matter how well we eat. We need to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much work to be done.
Right. And as a vegan, I can sleep at night knowing that I'm not participating in the violence and killing of so many animals. So I sleep fine. So I have the energy to do all that needs to be done now, really, in trying to help the world to go vegan. And I'm happy to represent the most responsible eating and living possible.
Yoo-hoo! Amen to that. Well, you know, Some of us activists don't do as well sleeping at night because we think about all the horrible things that are going on, and that makes it tough.
It does. It does. I mean, that is true, you know, but once we've awakened to it, you know, we have our cause and our mission, and I think, you know, what we have to do to help the animals and help people with their health. There you are, Sloan Kettering, and, you know, the number one carcinogen Americans are exposed to is, you know, the dairy protein.
That's
and
right.
There you have cream cheese being served. You
front
know, so,
and center, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, we're helping the animals, we're helping people, human health, and the environment. Everybody, if climate change has its way, nothing will matter. We'll all be extinct, you know, but... according to World Watch Institute climate specialists, animal agriculture, our appetite for meat, dairy, fish, and eggs is causing at least 51% of all greenhouse gas emissions. So,
you know, I'm glad you brought that up. Let's talk about that, shall we? A little bit more.
Let's talk about that. Definitely.
Now, I love the World Watch Institute has come out with some really great articles. They're not as vegan promoting as I'd like them to be, but you know, they did support Robert Goodlin and Jeff Anhang's articles, and the one that came out where they compared the data that was interpreted in the Food and Agriculture Organization's report in 2006, which said 18% of human-induced global warming was caused by animal agriculture.
Which is amazing in itself, because that
it
represents
was.
A figure more than all transportation combined, more than
it put
all
it
cars,
on,
trucks,
it put,
boats, planes, at 18%.
It was amazing, and it put it on the map, and people started to talk about it, and that was great.
Mm-hmm.
I don't always stick to numbers. I love numbers. I'm a total data person. But when I dug into global warming potential and understanding all of this stuff, there's a lot of numbers that are estimates. They're good estimates, but they're estimates. So none of these numbers are really exact.
Mm-hmm. Right. Of course, nothing would be exact. Look at the UN Food and Agriculture Organization's report. First, we must realize that the FAO is a pro-meat
right.
organization. That's and then if you look, people can Google livestock and climate change for the Goodland-Anhang analysis of that. You see how flawed that UN report is. That they're working off of estimates of numbers of animals being produced that. Really questionable, and they leave out so much information. They quote figures from the 1960s. They use Minnesota as the great example of farming, so that farming around the world looks more efficient. I mean, really, if you analyze, they left out respiration. They didn't think about animals breathing,
Yeah. And they were also inconsistent. They would use certain numbers in one formula and then use different numbers from a different time period. A lot of inconsistency. And,
mm-hmm.
But, this is a mammoth problem, and it's very hard for us simple humans to really get hold of. And to
mm-hmm.
calculate numbers, it's just crazy. But
right.
I think
So basically, if you look at it, everything that people do combined – doesn't equal the responsibility of animal agriculture's role in climate.
Pretty much, yeah.
So if climate specialists and nobody at the UN was a climate specialist. I mean, we have
That's right.
World Bank climate specialists who are estimating that at least 51% of all human caused greenhouse gas emissions come from animal agriculture. So. I'm with them on that. They've given me some of the best environmental ammunition that I have in trying to convince people to go vegan, and that is my cause. I mean, my show is called Go Vegan. There's no ulterior, there's no hidden agenda here, in the sense that, first and foremost, there's the moral aspect, which is, people need to realize that they're participating in the greatest massacre ever. You're paying somebody to do something behind the windowless walls that if we're done on the street, you go running to protect the animals, and yet we're financing mass murder, killing, torture, mutilation. And, I think we need to come to recognize that, even though we're indoctrinated into it so well. I grew up in New York City, and every day at PS 152 Manhattan, they gave me my container of cow's milk and cookies.
Yeah, I remember reading that in your bio that you're a New Yorker, and you went to Queens College in my neighborhood.
Queens College. You're in Flushing. You're Flushing then?
I'm in Forest Hills.
In Forest Hills. I lived in Bayside.
Oh, my grandparents were there.
I went to Stuyvesant High School,
mm-hmm.
and so... I grew up really not knowing the source of any food, because I didn't know a school could have grass fields. You know what I mean? So growing up in New York, I thought peas and carrots grew in cans. Salami came from a salami tree. So I didn't know. And there I was at Queens College, cooking. Finally cooking on my own, living on my own, and I was preparing a chicken one night, and I mean I. And I saw the body. You know, what I was preparing, or whom I was preparing. It was amazing to me because before that, it was a nondescript cutlet. I had chicken cutlets. I had veal cutlets. It sounds so innocent to have a cutlet.
Yeah, it sounds almost cute. Mm-hmm.
It sounds cute. A cutlet is cute, but then the first part of the word is cut. Cut. They have
cut.
Beef cut. I have people telling me, I don't eat much meat. I just have, a little portion. It's like, the whole animal had to suffer and die, so your little portion, they don't do a biopsy. You don't eat the biopsies of animals, So it's like, it's really, And then if people only eat, a little, meat, dairy, fish, and eggs, then it's easy for them to stop, to get rid of it,
I do. I know what you mean. So, yes. Okay. Now, this vegan movement is very wide, and there are many different voices and many different opinions, and you don't agree with some of them.
Right.
You're pretty outspoken about it.
Yes. Well, if you just look at reality, it's easy to be outspoken about it. And I actually don't include myself in the same movement as many groups and organizations who might be considered. Well, who's in the vegan movement? It's not the Humane Society of the United States, which is run by a vice president who's a pig farmer who kills 50,000 pigs every year and says that he makes a $30 premium per pig.
Wayne Pacelli is a pig farmer?
Wayne Pacelli hired the pig farmer, the vice president, Joe Maxwell.
Mm.
And the Humane Society of the United States does not promote veganism. It promotes meat, humane meat, as if there could be such a thing. But, people want to hear what they want to hear so they can go on doing their destructive habits. So if a Humane Society of the United States says, there's no need to go vegan, just eat humane meat, well, then people then are off the hook. The animals aren't off the hook. But, so we have a movement that's really, I can't differentiate animal advocates from animal killers at this point, because you have groups like the Humane Society of the United States, along with Mercy for Animals and Farm Sanctuary and Farm and Compassion Over Killing and In Defense of Animals, who all partnered with the egg industry in support of an egg bill. They were basically campaigning for these so-called furnished enriched battery cages that they all opposed previously before they partnered with the egg industry and then supported these very cruel cages that were unacceptable to all of these groups prior to
Let's put the Humane Society aside, because they were never really a vegan organization, although there are more vegans working there now, but they were never a vegan organization. But these other organizations you mentioned, Farm Sanctuary, clearly a vegan organization, Mercy for Animals, vegan organization, PETA. Why do you think that they're doing what they're doing?
Well, I know that they're doing research, and research says we can get more donations if we use the word vegetarian, for example, instead of vegan. So many groups run away from the word vegan now, which really explains much more effectively what needs to be done than the word vegetarian, which has been hijacked by the dairy and egg industries, who laugh all the way to the bank on lacto-ovo vegetarians. These groups engaged in the largest sellout of animals ever. So their damage is done. They campaigned for Prop 2 in California, and nobody really understood what that meant. I was still talking to HSUS at the time because it wanted me to support this initiative, Proposition 2. I was told it was supposed to mean a bird who now has 8.5 by 11 inches of space in a cage would have 12 inches by 12 inches. I later learned that Wayne Pacelli was campaigning around the state saying California would go cage-free if Prop 2 were passed. Prop 2, the Prevention of Farm Animal Cruelty Act. That was the name of this.
Mm.
And And all it supposedly did was give more space to birds. That didn't really prevent much farm animal cruelty. And collecting 700,000 signatures for the initiative, HSUS told all the signature gatherers not to mention anything about being vegan to people. When collecting signatures for the Prevention of Farm Animal Cruelty Act, the only way to prevent farm animal cruelty is to go vegan and not pay people to be cruel to animals, and you know, so that people can eat them. So Prop 2 goes into effect. Nobody knows what it really means here in California. So this J.S. West egg producer says, well, all of these groups campaigned recently for the Egg Product Inspection Act. They've given the animal rights seal of approval to these furnished battery cages. We're going to build all of these battery cages, and we'll say now that we're Prop 2 compliant.
Mm.
Prop 2 compliant with the Egg Product Inspection Act, the birds are given 67 square inches of space. Not even the 8.5 by 11 or 12 by 12 that Paul Shapiro, the vice president of farm animal protection of the Humane Society of the United States, promised. This guy can't even protect animals from his own coworkers, like Joe Maxwell, the pig killer. And you know, if people really want to know about the Humane Society of the United States, go to its Facebook page. It's Farmer Outreach Facebook page, and you'll see it's all about putting a happy face on the diet of death.
Yeah.
So all of these groups put the seal of approval on these so-called enriched cages, which actually, once you put the furnishings in, there's less room for the birds. And the birds are all huddling on the side anyway, panicked. And we had all of these groups campaigning saying, now hens can engage in natural behavior.
Oh, please.
Yeah, oh, please.
Ugh.
So I really don't understand, you know, what happened, but, you know, the damage is done. And from now on, millions and millions of chickens will suffer because of the sellout by these groups. And then Mercy for Animals recently published something on its blog about progress for pigs. Tyson does a turnaround. The groups are looking for victories so that they can say, look, we've done something, now please donate more money to us.
Yeah.
Some years ago, Smithfield, one of the biggest producers of pig products in the country, said, okay, we're going to phase out gestation crates. Everybody sees how awful they are, seeing the mother pig dancing around in the crate. So we'll phase them out, you know, in 10 to 15 years. So that shuts up everybody for 10 to 15 years. And 9 years later, or maybe 14 years later, they come along and say, you know something, we can't afford to do it. We, I don't know what we were thinking back then, but it's too expensive. Sorry, we can't get rid of the gestation crates.
Right.
But 10 years ago, Wayne Pacelli was saying, this is the greatest victory for animals. It's revolutionary. You know, the only victories are when people go vegan. You know, there's this myth now that's being sold to us about, humane, cage-free, organic, local, free-range,
especially disappointed with Mercy for Animals because when they first came out with Nathan Runkle, they were pretty hot doing their undercover investigations, and you thought that they were going to be the edgy version of PETA and go where PETA wasn't going anymore. But it looks like they're looking more and more like.
They're looking more and more like. Yes.
Yeah.
They're looking more and more like the meat industry, to tell you the truth. I mean, they're cheerleading for Tyson, like this pig killer. And the thing is, you put out an undercover investigation, and but what's the point if you're not telling people to go vegan? Then an undercover investigation merely allows the company doing the abuse to come out and say, look, we had a few workers who they weren't, you know, performing according to our policies. We're putting in new programs, new education for our workers. Look, we're correcting everything. So go ahead, eat our buck hairball turkeys now, or eat our Tyson's pigs, or, you know, whatever. So
Are there any organizations that get the Bob Linden seal of approval?
I'd have to think for a while. Really, I think Go Vegan Radio. Probably. But yeah, you know, so and that's part of the reason why we're creating this World Vegan Summit and Expo in the Los Angeles area in this coming March. People can go to worldvegansummit.com. But, you know, we really need to refocus our activism. You know, I mean, even along the years when I think about it, how many fur-free Fridays I go to, and of course I'm against fur, and, you know, but really, I don't know many people who wear fur. I know lots of people who wear leather and wool and silk.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So where have we been? Where has our thinking been, you know, we want to abolish the use of animals for food and clothing and entertainment and experimentation. And we've really limited our activism. Who's asking people to go vegan? You know, vegans are shy to ask people to go vegan. I don't know why that is. You know, I mean, why we shouldn't deprive people of the information that you know, could save them. But I think maybe we feel like, we offend people because, you know, they're going to feel that, we're morally superior. You know, I mean,
Bob, you've been doing it a long time, and I've been doing this a long time. I've been vegan for 26 years and vegetarian for longer. And it's really a tough road we're on. I know that when I was younger, I was more militant, more abrasive, and for the most part, people turned off. They didn't want to hear what I had to say. And I've come to find that when I've been more patient, when I've been more, more gentler, and it kind of changed the tone of my activism, more people listen, and it takes time for a lot of people. I hear from people that, you know, I used to lecture to a long time ago, and they let me know years later that they finally made the change. Sometimes it takes a long time for these seeds to sow and grow.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so we must sow as many seeds as possible. And, you know, the message might change a little in tone from audience to audience, you
Absolutely.
Know.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but the thing is, I mean, we do need to recognize everybody is a victim. You know, everybody's a victim. The animals are a victim. The people who eat the animals are a victim. The people who work in the slaughterhouses are victims. You know, I mean, you know, how that must, you know, destroy their hearts also. But the thing is, we're out of time. You know, we've engaged in this. I mean, and we need a sense of urgency about it because it is a matter of life and death.
That's
it's
right.
Rape, it's torture, it's murder. So, you know, we have to have this sense of urgency. No parent wants to poison his or her child. You know, my mother loved me very much. If she would have had different information about what she was feeding me, things would have changed, you know. I don't think, you know, my father's parents wanted to poison him, but he died at age 47 of a heart attack. Mm-hmm. Everybody thought, oh, it's in our genes. Heart disease is in our family. It's in our genes. No, it's in our diet. It's on our plates, and we need to recognize that. And I just had Dr. Ethel Spin on my program a few weeks back, one of the world's foremost specialists on heart disease, who says that nobody has to have heart disease. You know, it's just this made-up thing because we're eating meat, dairy, fish, and eggs, and he's also opposed to oils in the diet, too. But so the thing is that nobody has to have this disease, yet by age 5 and 6, children are showing signs of it. And he said that by age 17, just about everyone is showing signs of cardiac artery disease.
Wow.
You know?
Unnecessarily, yep.
Unnecessarily, right. You know, all of this for animals to suffer and to destroy the environment. And, you know, and it would be good if vegetarians recognized that they're engaged in the same behavior. I mean, if you're consuming dairy or eggs, I mean, you might as well be eating the hamburger. You know, you might as well be eating the chicken because you're doing no service to your family related to health. As I said, the China study shows the dairy protein to be the number one carcinogen to which Americans are most exposed. So do we just go along with it and say, well, everybody's doing it, I'm going to keep giving my kids, you know, the McDonald's, the Happy Meal, the ice cream and all? Or do we take responsibility? I mean, the kids are depending upon us. They're depending upon us. What kind of world are we going to give them if climate change continues at the rate that it does? We're out of time. So,
and speaking of being out of time, we only have a few more minutes. So,
well, we're out of time.
We're out of time.
If we're out of time, the message is, Go vegan.
I agree with you. Now, just let's talk a little bit about the World Vegan Summit, because I always like to hear about positive things that are going on. So what is this about, and why is this different from other vegan conferences?
Well, I don't really know of many vegan conferences. The most recent so-called animal rights conference was organized by Farm, which was a partner in the egg bill, and Farm continues to have the Humane Society of the United States speak at its events. And so I think what we really want to do is gather together and say, look, it's important that we promote veganism. So we have wonderful speakers from around the world related to ethics and morality, health and environment. And we're just going to all come together. We're going to have workshops on promoting veganism. And you know, I wish that somebody would have told me at a younger age. I wish that somebody, you know, I considered myself vegetarian for a long time, you know,
yeah,
thinking,
me too.
You know, oh, who gets hurt? You know, I mean, there's just the cow needs to be milked, right? The eggs are produced anyway.
Ding!
Nobody gets hurt, right? Duh.
Yep.
You know, and, oh, well, the cow needs to be milked because she's raped and the baby's taken from her and it's guilt's revealed and she's murdered later. But, okay. And then finally, when I saw that information, it was like, wow, I should have given up dairy and eggs, you know, before anything. That should have been first on the agenda. So I think it's important. You know, it's really not that difficult, and it's not that hard if people are presented the information. And they rarely get the information. So, I mean, they're not going to get it from the media, who are controlled by meat and pharmaceuticals, you know, they're all, you know, all the axes of evil, McDevils, Murder King, Wendy's, Kills Jr., you know, all KFC, all of them, you know, control the media. So you don't hear, about what's the best thing to do, the right thing to do. People love animals. If you love animals, you have to stop eating them and their secretions, you know? And I mean, just think about, you're eating somebody's decomposing body. You know, it's filth. There are plagues and contaminations. The Foster Farm has this recall that goes on forever. The salmonella, you know, it's all filth from a filthy environment. So that's appetizing from eating death. You expect life. WorldVeganSummit.com, and we're just going to, you know, come together and look at, I mean, we're rejecting what has been given to us as a so-called animal rights movement, because it's not promoting veganism. It's partnering with industry now, animal
rights. Yes, with this phrase animal welfare, which is chilling.
Right.
We've come to the end, Bob, and it was very quick and very fun, but I want to remind you, or just let you know, you owe me a vegan lasagna.
I owe you a vegan lasagna. You know, I'd really like to come to New York. I don't know how I'm going to manage this. Like late September, there's going to be a demonstration for improving the shelter system, which apparently is dismal in New York City. And then the next day, there's the march, against climate change. I guess it's a march against climate change. And you never hear from the environmental groups that you need to go vegan.
Because it's
a bunch of meat eaters, you know, Bill McKibben, 350.org, you know. Okay, kids, let's all sing songs that we need to do something. And then he goes and, you know, eats meat. And so he's part of the problem.
Do you approve of the Cowspiracy film?
I didn't see it. I mean, I've seen the trailer on it, which seems to seems to.
I mean, bringing up environmentalists who don't talk about going vegan, and that's what this film is about, kind of exposing all of the environmental organizations that don't talk about going vegan primarily because of money, because they know that their donations will go down.
Exactly.
I just wanted to mention it because we've got a New York City premiere on August 21st at AMC Village 7. If anybody wants to check Cowspiracy out and find out if it meets Bob Linden's approval.
Right. And the thing is, these environmental groups, I mean, it's not just the issue of climate change. It's everything. You know, it's resource depletion. I, as a vegan, need 10,000 gallons of water to grow my food in a year. A meat eater needs 320,000 gallons. So 32 of me can be fed, you know, to one meat eater. It's deforestation. It's habitat destruction. It's, you know, I mean, so how can you be a meat-eating environmentalist, meat, dairy, fish, and egg-eating environmentalist? It's really impossible. And the groups tell you what you want to hear. You know, it's like the Atkins diet. It tells you what you want to hear. You want to lose weight? You know, eat a lot of meat. You know, where is Dr. Fatkins today? Where will the planet be tomorrow, you know, if we continue? So
it's going to be out of time like we are right now. So if you want to hear more from Bob, who seems to be limitless when it comes to
talking for 13 years about this.
That's right. You can go to goveganradio.com and hear a whole lot more. Bob, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food.
Thank you so much, Ken. I really appreciate it.
Okay, it was fun. Go vegan. Yay. Bye.
Yay. Go vegan today. Now. Bye.
Okay, shall we take a little break? I think so. And then we'll be back in a moment with Jason Del Gondio talking about the terrorization of dissent. Everybody, let's get back to talking about food, shall we? It's All About Food right now on July 29, 2014. I want to bring on my next guest, Jason Del Gondio. He's a writer, speaker, thinker, and activist dedicated to social justice. He's currently an assistant professor of rhetoric and public advocacy at Temple University in Philadelphia. His areas of scholarly expertise are in the philosophy of communication, social and political theory, rhetoric, and critical analysis with a focus on social movements and radical social change. Jason has appeared on television and radio and regularly speaks on college campuses and public venues. He has written on such topics as autonomy, immaterial labor, corporate control, the rhetoric of Barack Obama, performance art, the Occupy movement, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, and the relationship between neoliberalism and the university. Welcome, Jason, to It's All About Food.
Hi, Karen. How are you doing?
Good. So we're going to talk today about the terrorism of I can't say this word.
I know, it's tough.
Because it's a horrible word. The terrorization of dissent. You co-edited this book with Anthony Nocella, who we've spoken to a few weeks back on this program. Very chilling subject.
Yes, it is, and it's one of the reasons why I'm actually both excited and proud to have worked on this book. I see this book as a form of political intervention into a world that really needs to be exposed, critiqued, discussed, and debate. And so obviously we're talking about the AETA, which is an acronym for the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, and that's the focus of the book. And we basically bring together a cross-section of lawyers, scholars, and activists, and folks from sociology, anthropology, political science, rhetoric, philosophy, et cetera, and also kind of expose and critique and intervene into the AETA.
This book really raises the bar on this subject because you have all of these people with phenomenal credentials and intelligence. This is not, you know, some groovy little group of people complaining about some legislation that happened a little while ago. This is very serious.
No, I agree. I'm glad that you recognize that. I mean, one of the things we tried to focus on when we were compiling the contributors, et cetera, was bringing together people that really can bear witness to the problems of the AETA and speak and articulate about basically how it violates First Amendment rights, how it has a chilling effect on free speech, the right to protest, et cetera. And, you know, given my background in terms of rhetoric and communication, I personally can understand how perception works, right? And so if the larger audience or the readership or Americans at large see certain kinds of credentials attached to writers' names, contributors, they're more likely to pay attention and actually respect and take note of what's being said in the book.
Now, there's a lot of things that are scary about the AETA, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. First of all, anyone who is against the exploitation and torture of animals for any reason, primarily for food, but also for animal testing and all kinds of other things, this act makes many of the things that we do almost an act of terrorism.
Yeah, and that's actually, I agree, that's probably the scariest part of this act, this bill, this piece of legislation, is that basically, if you inhibit a corporation's ability to make a profit from the exploitation of animals, you could potentially be called a terrorist. Now, if you think about that, that's extremely scary.
I mean,
right?
I'm talking to people all the time saying, right, don't eat meat, right, let's shut down factory farms. Does that make me a terrorist?
Well, exactly. So, for instance, just a few weeks ago, two activists were charged with releasing minks from a fur farm, and they're being charged under the AETA with terrorism. Now, releasing minks is obviously an illegal activity, right? I'm going to assume, yep, that any activist engaging in that kind of activity recognizes the potential consequences. But then to jump from a legal activity of releasing minks from a fur farm to charging them with bona fide, quote-unquote, terrorism just doesn't make any sense. I would assume that any reasonable person looking at this case would say, I don't see where the terrorism comes into play here. Right? No human being was harmed and no animal was harmed, so how can we call that terrorism? And that's basically what the AET does. It sets a context, it sets a pretense for really trying to stigmatize, demonize, in many ways, quarantine animal rights activism. Right? So at this point, if you threaten the ability of a corporation to make a profit off of animals, you could be legally tried as a terrorist.
And this law came about even though there were already laws on the books that would punish for these types of illegal activities. This particular law really wasn't necessary to resolve what to do with those who have done things like you just mentioned and some other acts that affected property.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, let's put this into perspective here. So the AETA was passed in 2006 in the wake of 9/11. And, of course, this piece of legislation has the word terrorism in it. And in the wake of 9/11, anything with the word terrorism in it is going to receive priority. Right. Now, of course, though, this wasn't the first time this kind of law was passed. So back in 1992, a previous law was passed called the AEPA. So it was the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. And basically the AEPA has all the same laws in it, right? The AETA simply has accomplished the ability to lead with the word terrorism. So in many ways it's a PR campaign, a smear campaign, etc. Now even if we go further than that though, right, all these quote-unquote illegal activities that we're discussing are already outlawed by most states. So if we talk about vandalism, trespassing, things like that, we all know that these are against the law. Mm-hmm. So the question then becomes, why do we need this quote-unquote mega law, this federal law, to reinforce what's already being reinforced? And I think this really points to the heart of the matter here, right? By inserting the word terrorism into the title, it's able to demonize and stigmatize animal rights activists as terrorists. Right? And I would say that the AETA does at least two basic things here. One, it protects and safeguards corporate profit before anything else. Right? And unfortunately, that has been a mainstay of American society. We can point to all kinds of legislation, all kinds of laws and bills have been passed that really it's about corporate profit before anything else.
Yeah.
But then two, like I said also, it also demonizes the animal rights movement. And what happens when that occurs? It has a chilling effect on the freedom of speech and the right to protest. And I think those are the two basic problems, along with other things, but those two basic problems with this law.
Now, we never hear about this except on shows like this one.
Right.
Mainstream media is not talking about the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And some people might think that it just concerns animal rights activists, but it really affects free speech, it affects democracy, it affects any compromised group because we're setting precedent.
Oh, I agree 100%. And I think that's one of the biggest parts, or one of the biggest issues with this piece of legislation. And again, like you said, I think some people hear just the title of the book or the title of the legislation think, oh, it only applies to animal rights activists. That's not true, right? I mean, really, I think anyone who's concerned with creating a better world is now being threatened by this piece of legislation, right? And if we were to, let's say, apply the principles of the ATA back throughout history, we have a very different American history. And I say that because almost every right, liberty, and freedom that we hold dear has come by way of activism and by social movements. And just about every social movement that has ever existed has used civil disobedience, direct action, things like that. Right?
Now, I'm not a promoter of violence ever.
Oh,
but
no.
But all of these movements that you've mentioned have all kind of moved forward with a little bit of violence. You know, we had the Boston Tea Party, and...
No, exactly, yeah. I mean,
there's always been some destruction of property and some action to get people's attention.
Well, I agree with everything you just said. I would maybe just frame it slightly differently and say, well, hasn't every social movement, to one degree or another, interfered with corporate profit at some point? And the answer is yes. Boston Tea Partiers, abolitionists, women suffragists, civil rights activists, anti-war activists, LGBT activists, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. By the very nature of the fact that we live in a capitalist society and corporations have so much control, at some point there will be a power play between activists and corporate profits. Right? And what the AETA does, is basically safeguards corporate profits, saying it's off limits. You cannot even think about or talk about interfering with that process. Right?
Now,
that's problematic.
Yes. Now, this book, a lot of it talks about the history of the AETA, how it came about, what it is, how it's impacted people, and you have many different voices who give their spin on this issue from many different angles. And the part that I actually liked the best was part four, which was the interviews and personal reflections. I always love the individual voice on certain things because we can relate the best when we hear an individual voice,
yeah,
rather than getting buried in all the legal terms and he said, she said, and whatever. All of that's important, of course, but we're moved by an individual story, and each one of these is really quite profound.
Oh, I agree. And when I was working on the book, you know, co-editing it, things like that, and I came across these interviews and these personal reflections, I pretty much had the same experience you did, where to me this is the most moving part of the book. You're talking about individual lives that were utterly disrupted by this piece of legislation, right? And so in this part of the book, we have interviews or personal reflections by people who either have been charged with and served time in prison or the charges were dismissed. Either way, imagine FBI busting down your door at 6 a.m. and arresting you and your housemates, things like that. And then not only that, but then being stigmatized by the label of terrorist for the rest of your life. Even if the charges are dropped, how does that look in public spotlights when you apply for a job interview, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And I mean, these human stories that are told in part four, I think, are very moving, very troubling, and it really evokes kind of the urgency and the problematic nature of the ATA.
And the law does, in some ways, what it intended to do, if you read between the lines, but it scares people. It puts fear into them as far as being activists.
Oh, sure, 100%. I agree. I really do think that is the purpose of the law. I mean, sure, the law does now have federal standing. It can be used to prosecute people, to indict people, to arrest people. But I think overall, though, it's a larger communication campaign to kind of have activists internalize this fear and thereby not act upon their ethical concerns about animals, the environment, and things like that. And I really think that is the purpose of the law.
Okay, so how are we going to get this law off the books? How do we go back to a real democracy with freedom of speech and not be afraid to speak out?
Well, I think the first thing is trying to raise awareness about this law. Like you mentioned a little while ago, almost no one has heard about this law, right? So the book just came out a few weeks ago. I'm talking to some friends and family members about it, and everyone says, well, how come I haven't heard about this law before? And I said, that's exactly the problem, right? So I think the first step is really raising awareness, right? Having open discussions, public panels, have experts come and talk about it, have reading groups, whatever the case may be, but I think more people need to be informed about the problematic nature of this piece of legislation. And then from there, we have to find a way to pressure our lawmakers to repeal this law. I mean, I definitely think this law should be repealed immediately because it's unconstitutional in violation of the First Amendment rights.
Now, there is one group that's trying to do that, and I think that's one of the last sections in your book. Let's see. Where is that? Do you know what I'm talking about? Where they
is it with Heidi Pogosian and the National
Lawyers Guild? The foie gras people, the people that were fighting foie gras and.
Oh yes, okay. Sorry, it's been a while since I've read the book myself, so I apologize about that. Yes, so there are groups of people that are trying to, you know, basically take the fight to the legislation, right? They want to go to court and try to demonstrate that the ATA is actually unconstitutional and a violation of basic rights, constitutional rights.
Oh, it's the New York City-based Center for Constitutional Rights.
Rights.
Yes.
Well, that's a type of organization that, by its very nature, would be concerned with this kind of act. And I would say something like the ACLU, National Lawyers Guild, all these types of organizations have a serious investment in understanding and overturning this kind of law because it basically violates basic things that we as Americans take for granted.
Mm-hmm. So far, this particular suit, Blum versus Holder, was dismissed, and now they're appealing the dismissal.
Yes, correct.
Yeah. So that's where do you think that's going to go? You have any idea?
That's hard to say. I mean, I'm not, a legal scholar by any means. I'm hoping it gains more traction. Again, one of the things in trying to expose the problematic nature of this law, actually the first weekend of September, I think it's the 5th, 6th, and 7th, some folks are organizing a national weekend of action against the ATA, right? And so a weekend like that is supposed to expose what's going on here, give, organizations like the Center for Constitutional Rights a platform to voice their concerns, get their message out, et cetera. And so hopefully that kind of weekend and other days of action, in upcoming months and years will give more organizations a better chance to educate the public on what's going on. And in doing so, there's kind of an inherent symbiotic relationship where all of a sudden the lawmakers are now on the defensive. Right. So if lawmakers support this law in the past and all of a sudden they're getting public backlash, now they're forced to defend their stance and maybe rethink their stance. And that's kind of the whole purpose here.
Okay, that's good. One of the chilling things, the whole book was chilling, but one of the chilling things was reading about the FBI and how it's like they're keeping an eye out on animal activists, just looking all the time just to see if they can find us doing something wrong, to catch us in the act, and spending a lot of money doing this where, if you know anything about an animal activist, we're compassionate people.
Right.
We don't believe in the exploitation of anything. We don't believe in violence of anything. I don't believe in killing anything.
Right. No, I agree. Right? So if you think about all the problems that are going on in this country or around the world,
that's where they want to focus their attention, yeah.
Why do they want to focus their attention on animal rights activists? And I would say, okay, well, two things. One, you're right. To think about it in the context of you have basically pacifists of one kind or another, right? Having organizing meetings, having speaking gigs, things like that, and all of a sudden FBI agents will show up to make sure that you're not breaking the law, right? And out of all the things they could focus on, they're focused on animal rights activists.
Mm-hmm. Right?
But then, two, implied in what you were saying earlier, think about how much money it costs the FBI to do that, right? So basically talking about taxpayer money, right?
Yep.
So is that the most sensible way to spend taxpayer money? And I would say no, right? There are a lot more pressing issues in this world other than, animal rights activists protesting a company or corporation a certain kind of farming tactic.
And then the other part is how they have paid people to work undercover to infiltrate some animal rights organizations, and in some ways kind of encourage them to do the wrong thing and then get caught in the act.
Yes, unfortunately, that is a reality that we live with now. Now, of course, this is not entirely new. I mean, we can go throughout history and talk about how different law enforcement agencies have infiltrated certain social movements, activist groups, et cetera, most famously COINTELPRO from the 1950s and 60s, et cetera. Now, some Americans think, well, that was just in the past. That doesn't happen anymore. Mm-hmm. But that's not true, though. It does happen. And like you're saying, it's happening with animal rights activists, which really makes no sense whatsoever in my mind.
Oh, goodness. Well, that's where our tax dollars are going. But you know that the tax dollars are just being spent in order for a few to be protected so that they can keep making a lot of money.
Oh, exactly.
And that's what it's all about.
Right. Well, it goes back to the subtitle of the book. So the subtitle of the book is Corporate Repression, Legal Corruption, and the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And the first two parts of that subtitle, Corporate Repression and Legal Corruption, is basically talking about what we're discussing here, in the sense that corporations have so much ability, so much power to influence and basically corrupt the political system and the legal system, right? And so certain laws and policies are being passed not for the good of the public, but for the good of corporate profits. And that's a serious issue in this country and with this particular piece of legislation.
Okay, so let's wrap this up, and I asked before what can we do about it, but let's just highlight a few things that all of us can do right now.
Well, I would say first and foremost is to become more educated about this law. And I would actually encourage all of our listeners to just Google the AETA or the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, and you can actually find the actual bill online. It's only 2 pages long, right? So I would encourage readers to go out, look it up, and read it for themselves, and really decide on their own account why this is problematic. And as you read it, it's really not complicated. It's very broad, it's very vague, et cetera. And as you read between the lines, you can see how it's intending to demonize and stigmatize animal rights activists. Then from there, though, I would encourage everyone to get more politically involved. You know, contact your lawmakers, contact your local radio or news stations, encourage more outlets to cover this story, encourage lawmakers to explain why this is on the books. And if they can't explain it, then put their feet to the fire and ask them to repeal the law. That's what I would basically do. So one, become more educated, and then two, ask lawmakers to repeal this law as soon as possible.
Okay, that's everyone's assignment. You have to Google Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act and read it. And then if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me at info@realmeals.org, and then I'll send them off to Jason, and he'll respond, right?
Yes, definitely.
And is there a way to find you? Is there a website or something?
Yes, my website, just my name, so it's www.jasondelgandio.net.
Okay, jasondelgandio.net. Well, I think this should be a book in every law school, right?
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah, I agree that every law student should have to read this book.
Law students have to read this book. Good. Thank you for joining me on It's All About Food, and thank you for being a part of this, what do we want to call it, this expose.
Well, thank you for having me on. I find it always a great privilege to be able to speak about such important issues.
Yes, it is an important one. All right. Have a great day, Jason.
You too. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Well, bye-bye. What do we have, about a minute? A minute left. And we're listening together to It's All About Food. I'm listening. I'm talking. And As I mentioned before, info@realmeals.org, I really want to hear from you, not just about the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, but about anything related to this program or food. If you just have a question, shoot it off to me, please. I want to hear from you. And back to my website, responsibilityandliving.com. I hope you will look at the article that I just put up, my visit to the Head and Neck Cancer Congress, where I talk about all of the opulence and hypocrisy and how people are talking about all this great research to prevent these horrible cancers, and at the same time, they're serving cancer-promoting foods to all of the practitioners at the conference. It just didn't make any sense at all, especially after I talked to a few people who acknowledged that their treatments work better when their patients are healthier. Now, when someone has cancer, you don't think that they're healthy, but there are healthy patients or healthier people that do come down with these illnesses. I'm one of them. I had ovarian cancer, and I thought I was pretty healthy going through all of that, and I survived my treatment, and I'm thriving now because of the foods that I was eating then and now. Very important. All right. Thank you for joining me today. This has been another It's All About Food. I'm Karen Hartglass, and please have a very delicious week.